You know, there is a specific kind of anxiety that comes with building something you think is perfect.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You spend weeks, you know, designing a system, you put in all the fail safes, the circuit breakers, the safety nets, and all that.
All right.
And then you step back and you realize that the safety net itself, it might be the very thing that strangles you.
Wow, that got dark quickly. But you're right, that is absolutely the paradox of safety.
It is. And welcome back, everyone, to the Deep Dive. We are knee-deep in Chapter 7 of Jocelyn Dubey's The Infinite Investor. And I have to be honest, this chapter made me a little bit angry.
Angry? Really? Why is that?
Because for the last three deep dives, we have so dutifully built this beast of a system.
Right.
We built the buckets to organize our capital, right? To give every single dollar a job.
A very clear purpose.
Then we calibrated the lenses to survive volatility. We talked all about ergodicity, making sure we never, ever get wiped out.
Survival first principle.
And then last time, we spent the whole hour on the selection process. The twin engines, the ROE matrix, all to find these pristine, high-quality assets. We've built a machine that is literally designed to prevent us from going broke.
And that machine works. I mean, it is designed to filter out the noise, to cap your downside, and frankly, to keep you rational. Theoretically, it's a fortress.
Theoretically, that's the word. Because then here comes Chapter 7, and it's titled The Exceptions. And Dubey basically strolls in and says, "Congratulations on your beautiful fortress. Now let me show you how it's going to cost you $50 million.
Yeah, that's the tension, isn't it? This is exactly where the rubber meets the road.
It feels like a punchline to a very long joke.
It does. We're not talking about what happens when things go wrong anymore. The buckets and the lenses, they handle that. Today we're dealing with a much more insidious problem. What happens when things go too right?
The 100 bagger, the white whale, the stock that turns, you know, $10,000 into a million.
Precisely. And the really uncomfortable truth that Dubey just drops on us is that the rigorous discipline rules we just spent 3 weeks building,
The ones that stop you from losing everything.
those exact ones, they are almost mathematically guaranteed to force you to sell a 100 bagger long before it truly matures. The system is designed to kill the outlier.
So the mission for us today is, it's a tricky one. We have to learn how to break our own rules.
Do.
We're looking for the exceptions, the specific, very rare signals that tell us to take our perfect system and for a moment just throw it out the window.
It's about earning the right to be irrational. Or maybe a better way to put it is realizing that in cases of extreme success, the definition of what's rational, it changes.
Okay, so let's unpack this 100-bagger dilemma. Because on the surface, it really does sound like a humble brag problem. You know, oh no, my stock is up too much. Whatever shall I do?
Right, a rich person's problem.
Exactly. But the book makes this distinction between ex ante and ex post that really clarified for me why this is such a nightmare for investors. Now, I haven't taken a Latin class since high school, so you're gonna have to walk me through this one.
Of course. It's just fancy talk for before the fact and after the fact.
All
And
right.
I'm telling you, understanding the gap between those two is the single biggest key to understanding investor regret.
Okay, give me the ex post view first. This is the hindsight view, right?
Right. Ex post after the fact, it is painfully, blindingly obvious that Amazon was going to take over the world. You look at a chart of Amazon from 1997 to today, and it's just this beautiful, smooth line going up and to the right. It looks inevitable.
Yeah, you look at that and you say to yourself, "How on earth did I miss that? It was a bookstore, then it was everything, of course." It makes you feel like an idiot for not seeing it.
Exactly. But that is a lie. It's a lie your brain tells you with the benefit of hindsight. Because ex ante, before the fact, standing there in 1999 or 2002, Amazon did not look like a world conqueror.
What did it look like?
It looked like a company that was burning through cash, fighting a life or death battle with Barnes and Noble, trying to survive the dot-com crash, and facing lawsuits left and right.
So ex ante, a future 100 bagger, doesn't walk around wearing a little sign that says, "Say, I'm the next Amazon."
Not at all. In the early days, ex ante, a future superstar, looks exactly like a standard bucket four speculation.
Risky.
It looks risky. It looks messy. And this is the crucial part. It looks identical to the dozens and dozens of other companies that are going to go to zero.
And this is where the trap springs, because we have rules for bucket four. We spend a whole deep dive defining them.
We certainly do. We have harvesting rules. So if
Yeah.
you buy a risky stock, an amplifier, we called it, at say $10 and it goes to $30, what does a disciplined, rational investor do?
You sell. You sell enough to get your original investment back, you take your chips off the table, you lock in the win. That's what smart people are supposed to do.
You pat yourself on the back for being prudent, you sleep well at night, then the stock goes to $50.
Okay, so you sell a bit more to rebalance.
Right. It goes to $100, you trim it again because now it's overextended or overbought.
And by the time the stock hits $1,000...
You own 6 shares. And you tell everyone the story about how you called it at 10 bucks.
You gardened so responsibly that you pulled up the flower right as it was starting to bloom.
That is the systematic trap in a nutshell. The very discipline that saves you from the 99 losers also guarantees you cap your upside on the one massive winner. By following the rules, you absolutely guarantee a good return, but you also guarantee that you will miss the generational return.
Let me play devil's advocate here for a second. If I don't sell, if I just decide to hold everything forever because I'm absolutely terrified of missing the next Amazon, aren't I just going to end up with a portfolio full of junk?
That is the counter risk. And it's just as dangerous. If you never trim, you become a hoarder. The reality is most stocks do fail. Most spikes in price are temporary.
So you can't just treat everything like a lottery ticket.
You can't. If you treat every speculation like it's the next Amazon, your returns will be dragged down to nothing by the 96% of companies that disappoint or go bankrupt.
So we're stuck. If we follow the rules, we miss out on generational wealth. If we ignore the rules, we go broke holding on to garbage.
And that is precisely why we need a mechanism. We can't just rely on hope. We need an almost forensic way to identify when a company has, well, when it's mutated, when it has stopped being a speculation and started being something else, something that has earned the right to be put in a coffee can.
Okay, you dropped the term coffee can. I love the imagery here, and it's a central concept in this chapter. Where does this actually come from? Is it literally a coffee can?
It is literally a coffee can. The concept is attributed to a portfolio manager named Robert Kirby. He wrote a famous paper on this years ago. The story goes that he had this client, let's just call him the husband, who followed Kirby's advice religiously. Kirby would call and say, buy stock A, and the husband bought stock A. Kirby would call and say, sell stock A and buy stock B, and the husband would say, okay, and do it.
A model client. The perfect client.
You'd think so, except for one tiny detail. When the husband eventually died, his wife called Kirby to help handle the estate. And as Kirby was going through the paperwork, he discovered that while the husband did buy every single recommendation, he never sold anything.
Wait. He just kept buying. He never sold.
Never sold a share. He would apparently take the purchase confirmation slip, put it in a physical coffee can he kept under the mattress, and just completely ignore the sell orders. He ignored the rebalancing. He ignored all the optimizing.
And result. I'm almost afraid to ask.
The portfolio was a monster. It had vastly, vastly outperformed Kirby's own professionally managed fund.
How is that possible?
Because inside that coffee can, there was a little company called Xerox.
The copier company.
Back then, Xerox was a tech giant. It was like Apple or Google today. It was a true 100 bagger. Now, if Kirby had been actively managing the account, he would have trimmed Xerox 10, 15 times on the way up to manage risk and rebalance.
Of course. The smart thing to do.
But the husband, by doing absolutely nothing, let the compounder run completely uninterrupted. The gains from that one stock paid for all the losers in the can 10 times over, and then some.
It seems so counterintuitive that laziness, for lack of a better word, beats professional management.
Well, it's not really laziness. It's the absence of what we call activity bias.
Okay.
We are wired to think that doing something is better than doing nothing. We want to tinker. We want to optimize. We want to feel in control. But Dubé highlights this massive paradox here. The biggest single risk to a great compounder is often the investor interrupting the process.
We are our own worst enemies.
Absolutely. Just think about the real cost of optimizing. Every single time you sell a winner, what happens first?
Yeah.
You trigger a tax event. That's 20% or more of your capital. Gone. Instantly. To the government. Then you have transaction costs, which are smaller now, but still exist. But the biggest cost, the silent killer, is reinvestment risk.
Define that for us.
Okay, so you sell your big winner, you feel smart, you have a pile of cash, now what?
You have to find a new place to put it.
You have to find a new idea that is just as good, if not better, than the one you just sold. And that is incredibly, incredibly difficult to do consistently. You are essentially trading a known, proven compounder for an unknown hope.
So the coffee can approach, avoids all of that. You buy quality, you put it in the can, and you effectively just forget you own it. No trimming, no harvesting, no rebalancing. But, I mean, surely we can't just coffee can everything. If a coffee can a declining retail store, I just lose all my money, just more slowly.
Exactly. And that is the huge caveat. The coffee can is not a universal strategy. It is an exception. It's a promotion. If you put a bunch of amplifiers, those risky speculative stocks from bucket four, into a coffee can and just ignore them for 10 years, you will very likely wake up to a can full of dust.
So it only works if the right things go into the can in the first place. We need a filter, a really, really rigorous one.
We need a set of criteria that is so hard to pass, only the absolute elite of the elite companies can qualify.
And the book gives us exactly that. It calls them the five criteria of untouchability. I feel like this is the technical heart of the entire chapter. Dubé is very clear. A stock has to clear all five of these hurdles to earn the right to break our standard harvesting rules.
It absolutely is. This is the checklist. This is what separates a trade from a marriage in your portfolio.
Okay, let's walk through them one by one.
Yeah.
Criteria number one is invariant ROIC.
This is the heavy hitter right out of the gate.
Break down the acronym first for everyone, but then I want to fight a little bit about that word, invariant.
Sure. ROIC stands for Return on Invested Capital. Simply put, for every single dollar the company puts back into its own business, into a new factory, a new server, a new store, how much profit does it get back?
Okay.
If I put in a dollar and I get back $1.05, my ROIC is 5%. I'm probably a grocery store. If I put in a dollar and get back $1.50, my ROIC is 50%. I'm probably a software monopoly.
Right. So obviously we want high returns. That's investing 101. But the key word here is invariant. That feels like a very high bar.
That is the filter. Because look, in a bull market, when interest rates are at zero and the economy is just humming along, everyone looks like a genius. A luxury car dealer looks like they have an incredible ROIC. A home builder looks amazing.
Because everyone is buying. A rising tide lifts all boats, as they say.
Exactly. But those high returns are cyclical. They are, in a way, a mirage. Invariant means the company maintains that high return on capital even when the world is falling apart.
So we're basically stress testing the business model.
We are looking for the graph that is a flat line at the top, not a roller coaster. Did their ROIC stay at, say, 25% during the 2008 financial crisis? Did it stay high when inflation suddenly spiked to 9%? Did it stay high when a massive competitor entered their space and tried to undercut them on price?
This has to be incredibly rare to find, right?
It's extraordinarily rare. Most companies have what's called mean reverting returns. High profits attract competition. Competition drives down prices, and returns eventually drop back to the average. A company with invariant ROIC has a moat, a competitive advantage, so deep and so wide that competition literally cannot erode their economics.
So if I'm looking at a company and its ROIC bounces all over the place, 20% 1 year, 5% the next, 15% the year after, that's not it.
That might be a good company. It might be a great bucket three company to own, but it is not an exception. You do not put that stock in the coffee can. You follow the rules and harvest it. To be an exception, the money machine has to be practically broken, stuck in the on position, no matter what the weather is outside.
Okay, that makes sense. Criterion number two, frictionless reinvestment. This sounds a little bit like a physics term, but I have a feeling it's all about growth.
It is. This is what I call the lemonade stand problem.
Explain.
Okay, imagine you have a lemonade stand. It costs you $100 to set up, and it generates $50 a year in pure profit. That is a 50% ROIC. That's amazing.
I would take that deal all day long.
Of course. So at the end of the year, you have $50 in profit. You want to reinvest it. What do you do?
I build a second lemonade stand.
Right. Now you have $100 in profit at the end of year two. You reinvest that and build two more stands. Now you have four stands, all on the same street corner. What happens next?
I run out of customers. People in my street only drink so much lemonade. My new stands start cannibalizing sales from my old ones.
Exactly. You hit a saturation wall. You have the capital to reinvest, but you don't have the opportunity to reinvest it at those same incredible 50% returns. If you build a fifth stand, it just sits empty. Your overall ROIC dilutes.
So frictionless reinvestment means you never run out of street corners.
Basically, yes. It means the company has a market so large that it can absorb massive amounts of capital. We're talking billions and billions of dollars, and pour it back into the business without the returns dropping off a cliff. The runway in front of them still extends for decades.
This is usually where you see a big difference between, say, tech companies and traditional brick and mortar businesses.
Often, yes. Amazon building out AWS is the classic example here. They could pour billions upon billions into data centers because the market for cloud computing was, for all practical purposes, infinite at that time. They could reinvest frictionlessly.
In a company that can't.
A company that has to pay out most of its earnings as dividends because it has, quote, nothing better to do with the money, it fails this criterion. It's a sign that they've run out of high-return places to put their cash.
Got it. Criterion number three, the moat paradox. I love a good paradox. Usually we think of size as the enemy of growth, right? The law of large numbers says it's way harder to double $1 billion in revenue than $1 million.
Correct. Usually, as companies get bigger, they get slower, more bureaucratic, harder to manage. Gravity just takes over.
But the moat paradox says the opposite.
It says that for these very specific, untouchable companies, size is not an anchor, it is a thruster. The larger they get, the stronger and more dominant they become.
Okay, this sounds like network effects.
That is the most common and powerful form of it. Think about a credit card network like Visa or MasterCard, or a social network, or a computer operating system.
Right.
If I join the network as a user, it becomes slightly more valuable for you and all the other users. If a million merchants accept the card, then I, as a consumer, have to have the card. If a billion people have the card, then every merchant on Earth has to accept it.
So the bigger it gets, the harder it is for any competitor to even think about displacing it.
It becomes a feedback loop. The scale itself becomes the moat. If a company has this characteristic, we don't want to sell it just because it's getting too big. Its bigness is its primary protection. If you sell it because you think, well, it can't possibly get any bigger, you are betting against the fundamental physics of the network effect.
That makes perfect sense. Okay, on to criterion number four, non-existential volatility.
This one is absolutely crucial for the investor's psychology because here's the hard reality. Even the most untouchable stocks will crash from time to time. Amazon dropped 90% once. 90. It has dropped 50% multiple times since then.
So how is that untouchable? That sounds pretty touchable to me.
The criterion isn't about the stock's survival. It's about your survival. The stock price will swing wildly, but those swings must not threaten the portfolio's overall survival.
And this ties right back to the concept of the shield we talked about in our deep dive on allocation.
Right back to it. Because we have our cash bucket and our broad index buffer, our shield, we can look at a concentrated position dropping 30 or 40% and say, okay, that hurts. That's not fun to look at, but I am not wiped out. I can endure this.
So non-existential means?
It means the volatility is just noise to your actual lifestyle.
Yeah.
If a 50% drop in that one stock means you can't pay your mortgage or you have to pull your kids out of school, it fails this criterion. The volatility is existential to you. You have to sell.
But if the drop just means your net worth number on a screen is lower for a year, but your life continues completely unchanged.
That is non-existential. You hold on.
Okay, and that brings us to the last one, criterion number five. Inverted asymmetry. This sounds like something out of an advanced geometry class.
It's the mathematical argument for being lazy. I mean, usually we think selling is the safe move, right? We think, I've made a lot of money on this. I should take it off the table to be safe.
You never go broke taking a profit. That's the old saying.
Toubet absolutely hates that saying. In this specific context, for these specific companies, he argues that the risk of selling actually exceeds the risk of holding.
How do you even begin to calculate that?
You have to stack up all the costs of selling. First, you calculate the taxes you'd have to pay immediately. That's a guaranteed loss. You add in the transaction frictions. Then you have to factor in the reinvestment error, the high probability that the new stock you buy with the proceeds is actually a loser.
Okay.
And finally, you add the biggest one, the opportunity cost, the massive, unquantifiable risk that the stock you just sold goes up another 10 times after you're out.
And when you add all of that up.
For these rare companies, the total cost of action is mathematically higher than the risk of a temporary 20 or 30% drawdown in the stock. The math completely flips. The truly dangerous thing to do is to click the sell button.
Wow, that's a powerful shift in mindset. Usually we're taught that doing something is how you manage risk. Here, the book is saying doing nothing is the real risk management.
For these specific cases, precisely.
So, okay, let's say we find this unicorn, this mythical beast of a company. It meets all five criteria. It has the invariant ROIC, the frictionless reinvestment, the moat paradox, the non-existential volatility, and the inverted asymmetry. It's truly untouchable. It goes into the coffee can.
And this is where the trouble really starts.
Because now we run headfirst into a major conflict with all of our earlier rules. The book calls this veto power and the rich person's problem.
It's a great problem to have, don't get me wrong, but it is incredibly stressful. Remember back in section 3 on allocation, we said bucket 3 are high quality compounders should be roughly 50% of the total portfolio. And we said that generally no single position should be more than 5 or maybe 10%.
Right. Diversification 101. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. That is literally rule number 1 of finance.
But what happens when one of your 5% positions, purely through internal compounding, not because you bought more, grows and grows and grows until it becomes 40%, 50%, or even 60% of your total portfolio?
I mean, traditional financial advice would be screaming at you. Sirens would be going off. Rebalance, you are dangerously overexposed. This is reckless.
They would say you have to trim it back down to 5%. But here, Dubé introduces the exception rule. If that position still meets all 5 of the untouchability criteria, the exception has veto power over your allocation rules.
Meaning you just ignore the allocation chart? You let the monster eat the rest of the portfolio.
I'll let it run.
Yes.
This is how you resolve the rich person's problem.
I mean, think about the early Microsoft investors, or the people who bought Berkshire Hathaway in the 70s, or even the secretaries at Google who got stock options. If they had followed standard rebalancing rules, they would have sold their winning lottery tickets every single year to buy, well, to buy something worse.
They would have paid enormous amounts in taxes and completely missed out on the truly exponential part of the growth curve at the very end.
Exactly. So the book reframes the entire risk question. The question shifts from, is this position too big, to, if this position drops 50% tomorrow, am I still in the game? Survival again. It always comes back to survival.
It is always the top of the pyramid. If your shield, your cash, and your broad indices ensures that your lifestyle and financial survival are completely intact, even if that one giant position crashes, then the position is allowed to remain. You don't chop down a redwood tree just because it's taller than all the shrubs in the garden.
I love that analogy.
Mm-hmm.
But this brings up a massive figure in the investing world. You simply cannot talk about holding things forever and letting your winners run without talking about Warren Buffett.
The Oracle of Omaha himself.
The book calls this section the Buffett nuance, because there's this pervasive myth out there that Buffett never sells. He has this very famous quote, "Our favorite holding period is forever."
And that has to be one of the single most misunderstood quotes in all of finance. People take it so literally, they think it means buy it and never ever sell it no matter what happens.
But that's not what he does.
Not at all. Forever is a philosophy. It's a mindset. It's not a contract. The simple fact is, Warren Buffett does sell.
Yeah, he dumped all the airlines in 2020. He's been trimming Apple for a while now. He has exited major bank positions entirely.
So we have to ask the important question, why? If he loves forever so much, why is he hitting the sell button?
And the distinction the book makes is absolutely key here. He doesn't sell to lock in profits. He's not selling just because a stock went up a lot.
No. He sells only when the risk of ruin rises. The book breaks this down into 3 very specific risks that can override the forever rule.
Okay, let's look at them. The first one is sector risk.
This is an existential threat to the entire industry a company operates in. This is exactly why he sold the airlines during the pandemic.
Hmm.
It wasn't just that the stock price dropped, it was that the world fundamentally changed.
Right.
Business travel stopped, Zoom took over meetings. The fundamental economics of flying millions of people around the world in metal tubes changed overnight.
So the entire thesis for owning that whole sector just evaporated.
Exactly. It wasn't just a bad quarter for one company. The sector itself was under threat of potential collapse. So he exited.
Makes sense. Okay, the second one is concentration risk.
This is where the recent Apple trimming comes in. Apple, through its own success, grew to be a massive, massive chunk of Berkshire's equity portfolio. And even for Buffett, there is a limit.
So even the coffee can has a lid on it.
It has a pressure release valve, let's say. When a position becomes so large that its potential failure would be catastrophic to the entire firm, meaning if Apple went to 0, Berkshire itself would be in serious trouble. He trims.
So he's not selling out completely.
No, but he is managing the overall size to ensure the survival of the mothership.
And the third and final reason is thesis risk.
This one seems the most straightforward, but it's often the hardest for people to admit. This is when the original reason you bought the company in the first place is fundamentally broken. Not just challenged, but broken.
OK, Can you give me an example?
Sure. Let's say you bought a newspaper company in 1990 because it had a local monopoly on advertising. That was the thesis. And then the internet comes along and Craigslist eats all the classified ad revenue for lunch.
The thesis is dead.
The monopoly is gone. It's not coming back. You don't hold on forever, hoping it will. You sell.
So the big lesson from Buffett isn't hold on blindly no matter what.
No. The lesson is that forever means holding until the fundamental risk profile changes for the worse. Even the most untouchable businesses are sold if they begin to threaten your survival.
This idea of things changing leads us perfectly into the next section of the chapter, bucket graduation. The book makes a really strong point that stocks aren't statues. They don't just sit in one bucket for their entire lives. They move around.
Fluidity is absolutely key. Companies evolve, they grow up, they mature, and sometimes they grow old and decline.
Let's talk about the happy path first, the graduation path. This is a stock moving from bucket 4, the speculation bucket, up to bucket 3, the compounder bucket. Mm-hmm.
This is the dream scenario for an investor. You buy an amplifier, a risky high growth speculation. The book uses the Tesla example, which is just perfect because it was so controversial for so long.
Right, let's go back to say 2018 or 2019. If you bought Tesla stock back then, it was absolutely 100% a bucket 4 stock.
Well, no question. It was production hell. Elon was literally sleeping on the factory floor. They were burning cash at an alarming rate. The shorts were circling like vultures. There was a very, very real risk of bankruptcy.
So you would have treated it as a speculation. You'd have your strict harvesting rules in place.
You would. But then, against all odds, it succeeds. It survives the Model 3 ramp up. It turns a profit. It gets added to the S&P 500. It starts to dominate the global EV market. The cash flows turn consistently positive.
So it's no longer a speculation. The bankruptcy risk is basically off the table.
Right. It has graduated to bucket 3. It is now a compounder. And this is a critical transition. It means you stop applying the aggressive harvesting rules of bucket 4. You don't sell it just because it's up 3x anymore. You transition to holding it for the long term. You essentially stop dating the stock and you marry it.
But marriages can end in divorce, which brings us to demotion. Moving a stock from bucket 3 back down to bucket 4.
This is the painful one. This is when a company you thought was a great compounder sees its moat start to erode. The example given in the book is Intel.
Oh, Intel, the former king of chips. A classic bucket 3 compounder for decades. If you looked at Intel in, say, 2010, it had everything. It had invariant ROIC. It had a massive moat.
It was the definition of a safe, blue-chip tech stock, Intel inside. But then, the thesis started to weaken. They completely missed the boat on mobile chips. Then they started to struggle with their foundry strategy. They lost their manufacturing lead and market share to competitors like TSMC and AMD.
So the invariant ROIC wasn't so invariant anymore.
Not at all. So yeah. What do? You have to be ruthless. It gets demoted. It moves from bucket 3 down to bucket 4. It becomes a turnaround speculation.
Now the consequences of that demotion are real. It's not just a label.
They are very real. The first thing you do is reduce the position size immediately because you don't hold a 10 or 15% position in a speculation. And you reapply those strict harvesting rules. If it manages to recover, you sell into that strength because it's no longer trusted as a reliable compounder.
And then there's that final rare ascension from bucket 3 to untouchable.
Into the rare air. This is when a great compounder proves itself over decades, meets all 5 of those incredibly strict criteria, and finally enters the coffee can for good. Berkshire Hathaway itself is the prime example here. It just keeps working decade after decade.
Okay, so we have the system. We have the exceptions. We have the fluidity between the buckets. But Dubé spends the last part of the chapter warning us that these exceptions are dangerous. They're like handling plutonium. If you mishandle them, you blow up your entire portfolio.
Yeah.
This brings us to the 5 fatal errors.
These are the big, bright warning label. He's basically saying that exceptions are earned privileges, not rights. If you abuse them, you are going to get burned.
Let's run through them. Error number 1, the categorization error.
This is probably the most common mistake made in bull markets. It's treating a speculation like it's a compounder. A risky stock with no profits, doubles or triples, and the investor just falls completely in love with it.
It's going to the moon. I'm never selling this thing.
Exactly. They decide it's a long-term hold based purely on the recent price action, not on the underlying business fundamentals. They take a sketchy biotech company or a hot meme stock and they mentally put it in their coffee can.
And then what happens?
And then it crashes 70 or 80%. Because it was never a high-quality, durable compounder. It was just a hyped-up cyclical trade. And now your capital is trapped in a stock you have no business owning for the long term. You basically married a stranger you met in Vegas.
Ouch. Okay, error number two. Mm. The interruption error.
This is the exact opposite problem. This is selling a true compounder, a true untouchable, just to lock in profits. You interrupt that beautiful exponential curve. You pay unnecessary taxes. You take on all that reinvestment risk we talked about. You essentially killed the goose that was laying golden eggs because you wanted to go buy a chicken.
Error number three, the leverage error. This one just sounds scary.
It is the deadliest of them all.
Yeah.
This is using margin borrowed money on your concentrated positions.
So you have this high conviction untouchable stock. It's now 40% of your portfolio. And you think, I am so sure about this, I'm going to borrow money to buy even more.
And in that moment, you have turned an infinite game into a finite one. Because if that stock has a perfectly normal 40% drawdown, which remember is allowed in the coffee can, your brokerage doesn't care about your long-term thesis. They issue a margin call.
And you are forced to sell at the absolute bottom.
You hit the absorbing barrier, as Dubé calls it, and you get wiped out. Never, ever, ever leverage a concentrated position. It is the only way to go broke owning one of the best stocks in history.
A sobering thought. Okay, error number four, the tax tail error.
This is letting the IRS dictate your investment strategy. You hear it all the time. I can't sell this deteriorating business because I've held it for 20 years and the tax bill will be huge.
The tax tail wagging the investment dog.
Precisely. Listen, as Dubé says, a 20% tax on a big gain is infinitely better than a 100% loss on a complete reversal. If the thesis is broken, you pay the tax and you move on. Don't ride a sinking ship all the way to the bottom of the ocean just to avoid paying the toll.
And finally, error number five. We have to talk about this one because, frankly, I feel personally attacked by it. The narrative error.
This is the one that kills the most retail investors, I think.
This is when you fall in love with the story, isn't it?
Yeah.
They're revolutionizing transportation, or they're going to mine asteroids, or they're disrupting the entire financial system.
It's intoxicating. These grand narratives release dopamine in your brain. You feel like you're part of a movement. You aren't just buying a stock. You're funding the future. The problem, as Dubé puts it so coldly, is that narratives do not compound.
Ouch. That stings.
Only cash flows compound. You can have the most beautiful, inspiring story in the world. We are going to cure all diseases. But if the ROIC isn't there, if the unit economics don't work, the compounding math still equals zero.
We see this constantly in the tech world. A company has a visionary CEO, a sleek product, a cult-like following, and negative gross margins.
And the investor holds on. They ignore the harvesting rules because they believe in the mission. They tell themselves, I'm coffee canning this because it is the future.
But what they're actually doing is just committing the categorization error all over again. They put a speculative story into the untouchable bucket.
Exactly. And when the narrative inevitably breaks, and all narratives break eventually, the stock drops 80 or 90%. If you had treated it like the speculation it was, you would have sold at 3x or 5x. But because you treated it like a religion, you wrote it all the way back down to earth.
So the lesson is, love the business, not the story.
And if you find yourself explaining why you own a stock, and you're using words like revolution, paradigm shift, or visionary, but you're not mentioning words like free cash flow, or return on capital, or margins, you are probably in the narrative error. Put the coffee can away.
Okay, so we have rules. We have exceptions to those rules. We have fatal errors to avoid. It's getting pretty complicated. How do we make a decision in the heat of the moment when the market is crashing or soaring and I have a dozen different rules and voices in my head? What do I actually do?
The book provides a final, simple tool for this, a hierarchy of decisions. It's a way to resolve these conflicts when the rules seem to collide.
This is the final checklist. I'm picturing a pyramid.
Exactly, a pyramid of priorities.
Okay, so at the very top, level one, the absolute peak of the pyramid, is survival.
The ergodicity lens, the first and only question that matters above all else. Does this decision threaten my ability to stay in the game? If the answer is yes, you stop. I don't care how good the upside looks. I don't care if it seems like a sure thing. If it risks ruin, the answer is always no. Survival overrides everything else.
Okay, so if survival is intact, we move down to level two, untouchability criteria.
Right. If survival is assured, meaning your shield is strong, we then ask, does this specific position meet all five of those tough criteria? If the answer is yes, Then we suspend the normal allocation rules. We let it run. We give it veto power.
And if it doesn't meet the criteria, we go to level 3, allocation rules.
Exactly. If it's not a true untouchable exception, we fall back to our system. We look at the portfolio balance. Are our buckets in the right proportions? If not, we rebalance. We trim the winners that aren't true exceptions, and we might add to other positions.
And finally, at the very bottom, level 4, the base of the pyramid, harvesting triggers.
This is the default action. Mm-hmm. Has a non-exception position hit a profit target we set? Then we execute the sale, unless level 2 applies and has granted it a stay of execution.
So let me recap the hierarchy. Survival overrides untouchability. Untouchability overrides allocation. And allocation overrides the default harvesting rules.
That is the hierarchy. It's what keeps the system stable, but also flexible enough to handle the rare, extraordinary outlier. It allows for the 100-bagger, but it prevents the 0.
This has been, well, it's been dense.
Yeah.
But incredibly valuable. It feels like we've gone from building a rigid, impenetrable fortress to installing a secret drawbridge just for the unicorns. As we wrap up this deep dive into Chapter 7, what is the one big takeaway here?
I think the biggest takeaway is the discipline of exceptions. It's very easy to hear this and think, oh, great, now I have an excuse to just hold on to everything I like. But Dubay is screaming that exceptions are earned privileges. They are not rights.
You have to prove it first. It's not based on hope.
You have to ask yourself the hard questions. Has this position demonstrated untouchability through its actual performance, not just my hopes for its future? Is my financial survival 100% intact if I'm completely wrong about this? Am I acting on cold evidence or on emotional attachment?
And if the answer to any of those is uncertain,
then the rules apply, period. You stick to the system, you harvest, you rebalance. You survive to play another day.
It really feels like we've completed the picture now. We have the overarching philosophy. We have the buckets for allocation, the lenses for risk, the selection process for quality, and now, finally, the exceptions to handle the extreme outliers.
We have a complete framework, a robust system for navigating the inherent chaos of the markets. It isn't easy, but it is coherent.
So here's a provocative thought to leave you with, listener. Look at your own portfolio right now. I mean, really look at it. Are you interrupting your true compounders? Are you constantly cutting your flowers to water your weeds? Or, and this is perhaps even more dangerous, are you treating your speculations like they are untouchable?
Because the difference between those two behaviors, that is the difference between being rich and starting all over again.
On that note, thanks for listening to The Deep Dive. Go check what's in your coffee cans. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.